questions being raised about a problem that emerges when you define something very precisely. Whenever you define something very precisely, so inevitably the question arises, if that is the definition, if that is what makes the thing that which it is, according to the definition, so what about in those cases where that is not present? Now let me explain, practically speaking, because the way I've been describing it until now, nobody has any idea what I'm talking about. Specifically, with regard to the definition of what is a human being. What is the essence of Adam, of man, so to speak? That is to say, we recognize that the human being is a very distinct type of a creature in the sense that it has two aspects to its makeup, two components. One being the instinctual, the emotional, the imaginary part. The other, the rational, which a vital element of which is the capacity for abstract thought, for thinking, for learning, for knowledge. And these are the elements that make one human. That is to say, without the ability to have any kind of knowledge and thus make a moral choice and be engaged in the battle to overcome the instincts, according to this definition, one would not be truly human. Then one would merely be just perhaps a more sophisticated animal, but essentially just an animal. That is to say, we recognize the fact that man is by nature not necessarily human in the functional sense. Man chooses. Man emerges as human as a result of choice. And by virtue of the fact that he or she chooses to live a certain type of lifestyle, which is based upon control of the instinct, controlled gratification of the instinct, and the ability to pursue knowledge. That is the definition that we have given of the human being. It seems to be pretty basic and fundamental, and it's in accordance with the Torah. That being said, people have raised a question. And the question is, what about certain individuals that would seem not to be able to partake of this activity, essentially the activity of thinking, such as people who are severely retarded by birth and will live their entire existence on a purely instinctual level. They'll never reach the level at which they'll be able to think in a sufficiently sophisticated manner so that they'll gain true knowledge, nor will they even emotionally develop the capacity to distinguish between emotion and reality and to make significant choices that we associate with true, mature human existence. The question is, what are we saying? Are these people not human? How would we classify these people? This question, I believe, is much more of a psychological, emotional issue rather than a logical question. I just want to point that out before we go further. From a purely logical standpoint, it's not really a question. Because once you define something, so then, by definition, that's what a definition is. It tells you what the thing is, what the essence of it is. And therefore, anything that doesn't partake of it is not included. So therefore, it's not a logical question. If this is what it is to be human, and therefore, anyone that doesn't partake of these qualities will not be defined as human. The fact that that is the case in no way reflects upon the validity of the definition. If one has a logical difficulty, one can say, I don't consider that to be the essence of man. I wouldn't define man that way. That's a different approach. Then the person is using a logical approach. However, once you come to a decision, whenever you're defining anything, if you say that the definition of a bird will include the capacity to fly, so then any type of a bird or any type of a animal that doesn't have that capacity will not be a bird. It's not a question on the definition. However, from an emotional standpoint, it's difficult for people to accept, and I suppose that that's the approach that we have to use today, because people do feel strongly about this. People feel a strong sense of compassion and sympathy for the unfortunates, for the parents, and for the individuals themselves that are consigned to living a life, to going through life with this type of a handicap. And we should feel that way. We should. It's one thing when we define things, we have to look at the thing purely logically. We shouldn't mix up the two, that's for sure. When you're engaged in learning and knowledge and study, you do have to put aside your emotions of compassion. You can't study with compassion in that way. You can't allow the compassion. That's another form of shochat, so to speak, of bribery, because it disfigures and it distorts. Whatever the case may be, in trying to arrive at the truth, you cannot allow the emotion. A doctor cannot allow his emotions of compassion to affect his decision as to what the patient needs. A doctor that will be thwarted from arriving at the correct diagnosis because it is too painful to accept, to recognize, because his desire for a certain outcome, because of his empathy for the patient is such that it causes this distortion and he can't arrive at the truth, would be evil. That would be an evil doctor. The fact that he'd be thwarted by an emotion which we would otherwise recognize as being positive and beneficial would make no difference. It's a misutilization of emotion. A person has to recognize the place. There is a time and there is a place for the application of the emotion of compassion. There's a time and place where it is not to be given any consideration whatsoever. You see how the Torah approaches things. It was only recently that we studied the area of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And we saw both categories. The Torah approached it purely from the category of truth. From the category of truth, an eye for an eye. That's absolute justice. That's what the person deserves. And that's what we need to know. From the standpoint, however, of practical implementation, when you take into consideration human weaknesses and the inability of mankind to establish a society on the basis of such an exalted form of truth, of justice, so then the Torah took that into consideration and made a modification that it could be, the justice could be effectuated through the monetary equivalency. But the truth is the truth, and you have to know the truth. Therefore, when you're studying phenomena, you've got to look at it very, very coldly, so to speak, in the same way that a scientist in a lab is essentially must be indifferent to the outcome. The only thing the individual is not indifferent to is the pursuit of the truth. What are the facts, or what is the correct idea? Come what may. I want to add at this point in time that I think this is a very significant point, and I think that it's one that not all contemporary thinkers, contemporary philosophers, contemporary theologians, Jewish and otherwise, would agree with me on. I think that they would look at it, most of them would say that one has to have a certain element of empathy, sympathy, sensitivity, compassion, and so on and so forth. I agree with that, but I maintain that it plays no role whatsoever in the task of arriving at the truth. One has to differentiate between the requirements of arriving at the truth, of gaining knowledge, what it takes, and there, the greatest possible clarity is to be sought for to the extent that it's possible to remove oneself from subjective interest. Obviously, we're limited in that, so it's not always possible to get ultimate objectivity. That may not be possible, but we should certainly strive for that. That's in the arena of seeking the truth, that is to say, the reality, what reality is. Of course, we maintain that there is such a thing as reality. Many contemporary thinkers deny that there is any objective reality, and they just maintain that there's just a lot of subjective realities, which gives you a lot of freedom to pretty much say whatever you feel like saying, and not to be held to any account. This is not to say that we negate the elements of compassion. Compassion is extremely important. It's just that even there, one has to know what one is doing. One has to know the place, the time, the situation. A misuse of compassion can bring about tremendous harm to individuals, to society. A great deal of harm has been brought to society by faulty compassion, by misdirected compassion, by compassion towards people who were exceedingly evil, who managed somehow to convince people to treat them in a sympathetic kind of a way, then took tremendous advantage and brought about great harm to the world. Having said that, I want to respond to those who raised the question that this definition seems harsh, because according to it, people who would be mentally retarded would not be defined as human. To that I want to respond. I understand the question. The question basically is, what about those who do not fall under the heading of the category that has been described? That's a good point. However, you've seized upon a group that's a very small minority. What about the overwhelming majority of individuals that we're aware of? The overwhelming majority of people in the world do not fall into the definition of being rational, are not rational beings. How many people are we aware of that even accept this definition? Part of being a rational being would demand that a person actually accept that the essential component is the mind. The essential purpose is to live in accordance with objective knowledge, which is achieved through the mind. And that would mean to say that we do not accept as being self-evident that the premise of life is to simply do everything you can possibly do to satisfy all of your fantasies, all of your emotional wishes. However, the overwhelming majority of people that we encounter are living a life which is in which the mind, the ability to think and to gain knowledge, is not used as the prime mover. It's not the faculty which decides how a person ought to live, but to the contrary, it's under the subservience of the emotions. So one could have asked a better question: what about the overwhelming majority of people, past and present, who live their lives in a manner which is animalistic, in which the divine image does not shine through, does not rule, in which they do not live in accordance with the principle of discipline, of self-control, of choice, of choosing that which is true over that which is subjectively pleasing? The point of asking the question this way is to show you that the facts on the ground, so to speak, the amount of people that conform or don't conform, in no way undermines the soundness of the definition. As far as the attitude of Judaism towards retarded people, they would be classified, obviously, as human beings and entitled to the full dignity, compassion, sympathy, protections that any human being would be entitled to. Thus, all of the commandments that have to do with treating our fellow man, the Ahavta Rech Kamocha, you shall love your friend as yourself, the obligation to help the other person out, all the prohibitions against any type of hurting behavior, to inflict pain, to kill, to steal, etc., against a fellow human being, certainly against causing emotional suffering, to insult a person, all of these things would apply to that person in toto, in full. you have to recognize that the question of the definition of a human being takes place in different frameworks. In the framework of the halachic system, the system that we have to live by, there's no question that we can't make a distinction, we can't differentiate between different people. We define a human being in terms of the form, those who possess the human form. The species has a certain form. And thus, we have to respect that, regardless of the manner in which the individual, specific individual, is manifesting themselves or living their life. You can't go around making an inquiry to determine what level of human existence this person partakes of before you decide how you're going to treat that person. So therefore, all who possess the human form are defined as human beings. And of course, it's a great mitzvah to treat them with compassion. How much more so those who have handicaps, those who are in pain, those who have difficulties, the weak, the infirm, the retarded, they have to be treated with the greatest possible dignity. There's no question about it. And even if it's a situation where they don't perceive the insult. And let's pause on that question. It may seem harsh, but I just want to clarify the point. What about poking fun at people who are handicapped or otherwise retarded, whatever the case may be? What I'm trying to establish here would be a case where people may make fun out of this person, but this person does not perceive it. May even laugh along with you. You have cases like that, where certain people are very backward or retarded, and people are asking them to dance, and they'll get up and they'll start dancing, and everybody's laughing, and they think that they're entertaining everybody, but really everybody's laughing at them. So they themselves don't feel any pain. Would that be permitted according to the Torah? There's a verse in the Torah which speaks directly to this point. Lo sekalel cheresh. That is, you're not allowed to curse a deaf person. It's always interesting the way the Torah formulates things. Truth is, you're not allowed to curse anybody. That is not to say that when you curse someone, it has a certain type of a power. Most people have that kind of a feeling. The question arises, why is the Torah choosing this as the case in which to establish the prohibition? The deaf person. One can ask, what harm is done by cursing a deaf person? The person can't hear, is not affected by it. The answer is that it's an aggressive, hostile action, and it's affront to the dignity that must be accorded to every human being who was created with Salmo in his image. That's a very significant point, that it's prohibited to act in a manner which is disparaging to Tzelem Elokim, to the image of God. Indirectly, that reflects upon your whole attitude towards God. We've said it's a very important fundamental principle in Judaism. That's the basis of the idea of Kavod HaMeis, of honor to the deceased. The idea of Kavod HaMeis is instructive over here. It's very significant. It is the tremendous emphasis that Judaism places on the obligation to give honor to the deceased. For there too, one can raise the question, what is the problem over here if one does not show honor, the proper honor? You're talking about a corpse. This corpse does not function as a human being. It no longer has the capacity to think, nor does it have the issue of emotional drive. It's dead. And yet we're saying that we have to treat it as though we're alive. The answer is because there's a very powerful association. There's a psychological reality that the person relates to a corpse as that it's the person. Therefore, people get very upset if they should drop a coffin or whatever, if there's any kind of an indignity, because how could they associate that with the person? You're treating that person that way. Meaning to say that it's representative of something. So, if we are that demanding with regard to something which no longer functions at all as any kind of life, because of the association that it has to the Tzelem Elohim, the divine image, so that how much more so must we should be cognizant of the humans that are alive, people that are living, and to disparage, to make fun out of, to cast aspersions in any way, shape, or form is a grave sin. And in the truth of the matter is that on the unconscious level, it's really an act of degradation towards the Creator, because this is His creation, and you're diminishing the most significant element in the creation, that which has the Tzelem Elohim. That's the answer to the question, how do we regard people who are, so to speak, retarded and cannot function in an intellectual, intelligent manner? That has absolutely no bearing on their status. Their status is that they are part of the human race. There's no question about that, obviously, and they're entitled to the full protection of the Torah. If you're going to look at it purely from a philosophical standpoint and ask whether they fit into the definition in terms of the functionality, in terms of what the essence of a human being is and what the purpose of human life is, and do they in themselves fulfill that purpose, partake of that purpose, that's a different question. In and of themselves, it would seem that they do not. Now, I know, of course, we can give all kinds of reasons and purposes, and we could say that they do bring happiness to people, and they do serve as a means for other people to be elevated, because in dealing with them, it forces us to confront our own weaknesses, and it forces us to raise ourselves to a higher level of compassion. All that is true, but I hesitate to say more than that, to say, well, this is some type of an explanation. This gives meaning to their existence. The reason why I hesitate to say that is because, on a certain level, to me, that would seem to be very cruel. To say that they really do not fulfill any positive purpose in and of themselves, in terms of partaking of the true human perfection, but they are somehow or other a means towards enabling others to obtain a certain ethical benefit by being nice to them, to me that seems to be cruel. For example, the existence of poor people. Because there are poor people, it gives us an opportunity to give tzedakah, to give charity, and to be compassionate. It evokes compassion in us. It gives us the ability to free ourselves from a certain selfishness and to raise ourselves to a higher level. However, if what would you think of someone that, looking at the society, somebody who has the power, and recognize that we're lacking something because there are no poor people left in this society. Everybody's able to take care of themselves. So even people that are poorer than others, that are on the lowest rung, are now independent. They're not poor. They're not dependent upon the tzedakah of somebody else. And that person would say, this is not a good situation, because now there's no opportunity to practice righteousness, to practice charity. So the person would therefore choose certain candidates and take all their money away and put them in a state of poverty in order that others would now have the opportunity to practice tzedakah. So most people would say that that's a cruel thing to do. Why should these people have to suffer and be in that state of indignity in order for other people to achieve a higher ethical level? That's why I don't like these kinds of approaches that would seek to justify. Yes, there is meaning in the lives of retarded people. It's meaningful because other people get a different type of a feeling of gratification. Even the parents feel a certain connection and a gratification that they take care of these most helpless types of beings. And that's the purpose. I can't say anything like that, because to me, as I said, that does not make sense on an ethical level. I wouldn't use that as a theological kind of an answer and explain, that's why they exist. as though I could say that's why God created them. If that is the case, of course, one can ask me, so then what is the point? What is the purpose? What is the reason why these types of beings exist, when the entire purpose of the human race, the creation of mankind, of Adam, Hakol Bara L'Chvodo, that everything was created for his glory, that is, that man should have an opportunity to recognize him by the utilization of his mind and have a relationship with God? It seems to me that we really can't answer this question. This is not a common phenomenon. And as the Rambam points out in the Maariv Ochim, it seems to be that this is part of the world of matter. That in the world of matter, every so often, there's, I guess, what you would call a mutation. And these things do happen from time to time. Beyond that, as to why that's the case, or why God allows these types of things or the other, I don't think we have the capacity to answer those questions. It's the wisdom of God determined that there should be a universe, and the universe consists of matter, and once you create a universe in accordance with matter and so forth, there are certain consequences. And that's about all I could say. I can't go further than that. I can't explain it any further. When these things do occur, our obligation is not to be swayed by certain powerful emotions. Our obligation in terms of our relationship to God would be in the framework of what we would call tzedek hadin, to affirm the righteousness of God, that his works are perfect and all his ways are justice. And there will be things that occur that thwart us, that challenge us, that we can't understand. And I'm not giving all of the answers. I don't know. It's not for me to determine the ultimate destiny of a human being who's retarded. Because I don't know what the extent of their knowledge is, what they do know, and what's going to happen to their soul, and things of that sort. We're dealing in an area that lies outside of the ken of human knowledge. We do not know. Thus, we can't make any judgments. We don't know what happens to these people when they leave this earthly existence. It's something we really don't know, and we don't understand. All we know is that two things, that we have to accord them the full respect and dignity of human beings, and to allow ourselves to feel superior and to put them down and or disparage them in any way, shape, or form is a very serious defect. And secondly, that this is not the norm. This is a very, very small minority of the human scene. And when you're talking about the human scene, when you're talking about any type of a phenomenon in existence, you cannot judge and make determinations and make definitions by something which constitutes a very, very flimsy minority, all told. If you take the picture of all the humans that have ever existed, and what proportion of them would fill the criteria of being on the level where they're capable of thinking existence, of thinking life, as opposed to those who, because of some congenital issue, could not, it would be over 99.9% would fit into the category of normal human beings. Thus, you'll have also the similar types of questions. And what about people that are cripples, that are severely physically handicapped and have to undergo a tremendous amount of pain? And it's true, they may be able to use their mind, but they're incapable of achieving what we would call an ordinary human existence because of a different angle. Again, there the question is not as severe, because since we say, that's an important point to remember, the positive side of this definition is that in the arena of the handicapped, I would say that the amounts of people that are physically challenged and physically handicapped is probably greater. than those who have this particular mental handicap, to the extent where they're incapable of thoughtful existence. There you see a person like Stephen Hawking, the great physicist, who was an absolute cripple, can lead a very, very fulfilling existence, given that that would prove that the real essence of man is thought, is knowledge, is the mind. The life of the mind is the real life. Because it would be incapable. It would be inconceivable that if that were the case, that if you're going to say that the essence of man has to do with his pursuit of the physical enjoyments, if that's the essence, and the mind is just a tool which is to be utilized for that purpose, then how could you have a Stephen Hawking? Any individual like that, any physically handicapped person who was able to redirect the energies towards the attainment of knowledge and gain from that tremendous satisfaction, that wouldn't be possible. Just would not be possible. It's not possible in any type of an animal, even an animal with a high degree of intelligence. Because the intelligence is completely subordinate to the instinctual, and the essence is the instinctual. It seems to me that these cases prove that the essence of man is in the intellectual, the intelligent. And that is something which is separate. It's separate and above and completely removed. That is to say, it's a whole world in and of itself. To be involved in the world of ideas is something which is an experience that has absolutely nothing to do with the physical makeup, with the instinctual makeup of a person. When a person is involved, is carried away by deep, intense thought, involved in the world of ideas, is completely removed from every physical aspect of existence. He's in a different world. How is that possible? Unless there's something within him that is, it's not just a tool. It's not just a tool which is under the service of the instincts, but it's something which allows him to be attuned to a completely different framework, a qualitatively different type of existence. When he's involved in thought, he's involved in a different way of existing. And that is the true way of existing for Adam, for man.